too.
Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Solitude can be comforting at times, but isolation and loneliness can not only be very sad, it can harm our health. Our guest this hour is Dr. Dhruv Kular, who wrote a very important and touching piece in the New York Times in December, How Social Isolation is Killing Us. He's a resident physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. He starts by writing about a patient who is dying very soon, and the doctor asked, was there somebody that he should call, somebody he wanted to see? Not a one, he told the doctor. No immediate family, no close friends. He had a niece down south, maybe, but they hadn't spoken in years. Dr. Kular says, for me, the sadness of his death was surpassed only by the sadness of his solitude. He was isolation, he wondered, a driving force of his premature death, not just an unhappy circumstance. Joining us this hour to talk about how we break through this kind of isolation and to discuss how prominent it is Dr. Dhruv Kular. He's a resident physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, a regular contributor to the New York Times and The Atlantic and Slate. He recently interned at the White House Office of Management and Budget, focusing on Affordable Care Act implementation, and served as a fellow at Social Finance, exploring the potential for social impact bonds to fund diabetes prevention and management. Dr. Kular, thank you very much for being with us and for writing this really important article. It's just remarkable to me how many people are really totally isolated, and you tell these stories at the beginning of this New York Times article that literally make you cry.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you today. And I think you're right. The numbers are pretty staggering on just how many people deal with loneliness and social isolation in our country. And increasingly, I think what we're recognizing in the medical community is all the negative kind of physical, mental, emotional consequences that this kind of isolation can have.
Mm-hmm. And you were seeing patients around Christmas time. What a contrast to look on the screen, the television sets going nonstop sometimes in hospital rooms with all of these holiday celebrations going on. And you're treating patients who have absolutely nobody to say happy holidays or Merry Christmas or Happy Hanukkah or anything. They just have nobody.
That's true. And, you know, the numbers are, as I mentioned, staggering. But I think what really drew my attention to the issue and why I felt so strongly about writing about it was the way that people are struggling with it on the ground level. And that's something that I experience every day, but it's just so much more acute around the holidays. You know, you walk around and you see patients that are all alone in their rooms and they're watching Christmas movies. They're seeing kind of people walk around outside their windows and in groups that are going shopping, and they themselves are lying there in bed. And often, you know, they'll go days, if not a week, without anyone visiting whatsoever. And so those are kind of the things that served as the impetus for me to write about it. And it's, you know, as you mentioned, there's that patient that really touched me where he was about to die and he didn't have anyone in the world that he wanted to come see last time. But that kind of thing happens every day. You know, we have patients that don't have a ride home after a colonoscopy because they don't have anyone that can pick them up. We see older patients who are all alone in their apartments and they're not able to care for themselves. They're not able to clean their apartments. We see this a lot more now with the opioid epidemic, young people who are losing friends, losing family support while they're struggling with addiction. And so I think those are the types of stories that really motivated me to write about the issue, and I think have motivated other people to want to learn more about it and to get involved.
Yeah, and I like the fact that you end the article with really some inspiration and a way for people to start reaching out to others, which is incredibly important. We'll get to that. But let's talk about the health consequences of such social isolation. They're quite substantial.
It's right. And, you know, there's been studies that have shown that loneliness can actually be as big a risk factor for premature death as things like obesity and smoking, which we typically think a lot about in public health spheres, but loneliness and socialization is not something that we talk a lot about and yet might be as important a risk factor for early death. And so there's all sorts of biological mechanisms that people are now proposing as to why that might be the case. Social isolation is associated with poor sleep. It's associated with more inflammation in the body, more stress hormones. People tend to have disrupted immune systems when they're isolated. And so those are the types of things that might contribute to why we see these effects on poorer health. And then, you know, larger studies, more epidemiological studies have shown that people who are isolated have higher risk of heart disease. They have higher risk of stroke. One study pooled, studies from 70 different organizations and over 3 million people, and it found that people who are socially isolated are up to a third more likely to die within the next decade. And so these are really big, big effects that we're seeing here.
And I think that, most of us have gone through some periods in our lives where we've been lonely and maybe have spent 2 days not talking to another human being, and you have to go to the drugstore, or you find yourself wanting to take the trip to the drugstore just so you can talk to somebody. Oh, I'm talking to somebody. This is great. But imagine doing that day after day and week after week. And it's no wonder that, as you cite in the article, it can accelerate a cognitive decline, particularly in older people, to not have somebody with whom you're communicating.
Absolutely. And I think that kind of social stimulation is so important for all of us, but I think especially important for older folks that are more at risk for cognitive decline and dementia later in life. And, you know, one of the other points that I wanted to highlight in the article is that we think of ourselves as kind of a hyper-connected society now, right? Because of the digital age, and we have so many opportunities to connect online and through apps, but really being around other people in a physical sense is really important. So that's one of the things that I wanted to really highlight today and wanted to highlight in the article, that it's not enough just to be online. It really is important to be face-to-face with other people.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about this. You write about loneliness being caused in part by an unusual sensitivity to social cues. What do you mean by that?
So, you know, a lot of people, myself included, think that loneliness might be caused by people having poor social skills or just not having enough people around them. But some really interesting research has now suggested that it's not just those things. It's also how we perceive ambiguous social cues. So when someone does something or says something or acts in a certain way, people that are lonely or at risk of being lonely, they perceive those things negatively, whereas people who are less likely to be prone to loneliness, they might perceive that as neutral, or they might perceive that even positively. And so what ends up happening is if you perceive social cues negatively, you enter a kind of self-preservation mindset. And so you kind of withdraw from your social circle, and that can actually have a contagious effect where other people see that and they also start to withdraw as well.
Mm. And all of that can start when you're very young, when you're a child even?
It is. It is the case. And so, you know, other research suggests that social isolation in childhood leads to all sorts of poorer outcomes in terms of employment, in terms of health effects, in terms of family stability later on in life. And so researchers control for all sorts of other factors that might be contributing, but still they find that social isolation when you're very young can lead to a lot of problems later on in life.
Mm-hmm. What do you do? You're a doctor, and when you're with people, it's such an important time, the end days of life. What do you do when you are aware of this amazing social isolation, this enormous sadness you must feel as a doctor? Is there anything you can do to make your patients, even in the final days of life, feel a little better?
Well, certainly. You know, I think that towards the end of life, in the last few days, you know, we start to focus on other things as opposed to purely medical treatment, more on how to keep people comfortable, how to be with them. So just having a doctor or a nurse or another provider sit with that patient. We have chaplains that are on call in the hospital 24 hours a day that can be there. around the holidays, especially, there's a lot more in the way of volunteers that are around. But, you know, ideally, we start addressing these issues far before the end of life. And so we have the opportunity to intervene when people are at the beginning of life or in the middle of life or still able to kind of enjoy many of the things that come from being socially connected with other people.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, the last part of the article talks about what's going on in California, and I really hope this spreads all over the country where people can connect in such a meaningful way where it's good for everybody involved.
Right, right. And so, you know, there's a number of things that we can do very informally, a number of informal steps that I think we need to take to make sure especially older people stay connected. And so, you know, informally, I think making sure that older people have access to transportation, for instance, through things like discounted bus passes or special transportation services. If people are religious, we would want them to try to continue to be regular attendants at services and kind of benefit from the sense of community that, that might occur there. You know, if we have a grandparent or we have a parent who lives far away, we could ask their neighbors to check in. But the California program that, that you mentioned is a very, very interesting one that I came across. And it was started by a doctor named Dr. Paul Tang. And he started this program called Linkages out of Palo Alto. And essentially the program is what they call a cross-generational service exchange. And so the inspiration for this program is that everyone has something to offer. And when I interviewed Dr. Tang, he basically said that, you know, in America, you need an excuse essentially for knocking on someone's door, knocking on a neighbor's door. And what he wanted to do was break down those barriers. And so the program works by allowing members to post something online that they want help with. It could be any number of things. It could be they just want a Scrabble partner, or they want guitar lessons, or they want to ride to the doctor's office. And then other people who see that post can go over and use their time, use their skills to fill those needs, and in the process, quote unquote, bank a few hours if they need something else for themselves in the future. So one example that I give in the article is that a college student might see a post from an older gentleman who wants help with gardening. And so she goes over and she plants a row of flowers, and then she banks 2 hours in the process. And a few months later, when she wants to cook an exotic meal for her partner, now a retired chef sees that post, and he comes over and gives her some cooking lessons. So the idea isn't necessarily that you need someone with you every day, but the idea is that just knowing that you're kind of a valued and a contributing member of society can be incredibly, incredibly important.
Absolutely. It's just a terrific idea, and it's done online. That's how people initially make the contact?
It is. So they sign up online, and it's an app, and they're able to post things that they want help with or things that they can help with, and it's kind of a volunteer community that's formed. Mm.
And is it spreading around the country, Doctor?
That's their goal. Right now they have hundreds of people that are enrolled in the Palo Alto area and across California, but their next goal is to spread that across the country.
Oh, it's just a great idea. We want to invite people to call in. I know that many of you listening have experienced social isolation at some point in your lives, and maybe some of you are now, because these statistics that he cites in the New York Times article are amazing. One-third of Americans older than 65 now live alone, and half of those people age 60, 85, or overdue. So there is a whole lot of social isolation going on in American society right now. He writes about treating people who have no one at the end of life or in mid stages of life or earlier life as well, the reasons for that, and how it is we can begin to connect with other people, because it will make a huge difference on our health in terms of our sleep patterns, our immune systems, our levels of stress, the risk for heart disease, the risk for stroke. Social isolation is not good for our physical well-being, to say nothing of our emotional well-being. Here's our phone number. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Many, many phone calls coming in. I'm so glad. So let's go to them, and we start with Joan in Appleton. Hi, Joan.
Hello.
Hi, Joan. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my comment is this, and I didn't get the where did your doctor come from? What part of the country did you come from, sir?
I'm from I'm in Massachusetts now, but originally from Ohio.
Okay. Well, I'm here in Appleton, Wisconsin, and one of the comments that I wanted to make was that instead of looking at that solitary person who may not be lonely, to look at the community that quite often may have a big responsibility in being very exclusive and not reaching out to outsiders. I'm not from here, and I know I transfer here with my job, and most of the people that I worked with came from other places, and they all went back because they said that unless you're German, Catholic, or Lutheran, you were an outsider no matter how long you lived in this area. And I come from a town where we have the melting pot that really melted, but in some communities, they don't see any responsibility toward looking out for that single person or ever going outside of their comfort zone, their families. They don't look at people and say, gosh, I wonder if they are spending Christmas alone. My daughter recently moved to California, and she said, Mom, you just wouldn't believe how friendly people are out here. And I just thought that was quite a comment coming from a young person, but it just is really up to the community as well to bring people in and not just, I guess you can't change the culture of a particular generation or nationality, but you have to look at the community and how welcoming they are and how aware they are of people and including them.
Doctor.
Right. Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you very much for your comment. And I think that's 100% true. I mean, the sense of belonging and love and attachment, those are certainly bidirectional. And so part of that is the individual putting themselves out there and being able to kind of state that they want that level of attachment and involvement, but part of that is also the community reaching right back out. And so I think it's up to all of us, both individuals, doctors, patients, neighborhoods, communities, to come together to find a way to make sure that everyone is included.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's unlikely, but it is newsworthy almost. I was watching news, a few weeks ago, and they always do a story that's supposed to be inspirational, or usually do a story that's inspirational. And it was a gentleman, elderly gentleman, who had lost his wife, and he was very sad about all of it. And all of a sudden, he was at the grocery store, and this 4 or 5 year old girl caught eye contact with him and somehow was just delighted by his very being and wound up going over to his house. And they became like a granddaughter, grandfather. And it was just not related, but just this incredible connection, which really can happen to people if our hearts are open to that. Don't you think, Doctor?
No, absolutely. And I see that in the hospital as well every day, in that we often go around and go about our days kind of trying to get the next task done and to see X number of patients and do X number of procedures. But it's really up to us to take a step back and to think, how can I connect with this person? How can I really make a difference in their lives that's beyond just the medical and just the healthcare, and really see this person for who they are? And too often that doesn't happen. And then really we miss a lot of opportunities to make that kind of deep emotional connection with another human being. And so, one of the things that I want to continue to work on in my practice and encourage other doctors and clinicians to work on as well is to take a step back and to try to focus on how can we connect more deeply with our patients and those family members that they're with.
Mm-hmm. Joan, thanks for the call. Liz in Appleton. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that although I've worked for a long time with the elderly, I'm in healthcare, I'm now one of them. I guess I'm 65. I live alone, although I have my dog. Which is obviously great, as Kathleen knows.
Yes, they're great.
But I think that our very individualistic society never sort of prepared itself for the fact that, there would be people wouldn't be living generationally, and all of a sudden there are all these people for various reasons who are alone. And I think people treat you, I know as a single woman, there's a certain, you know, you're, don't know, there's a certain sort of, you never married. And then when you get older, you're sort of set up for that, and you really do have to try. In fact, I'm going to work in a few minutes, so I'm still getting around, of course. But it's just something that I didn't see. I haven't seen in other countries so much. I spent a lot of time in France, and I was in the Peace Corps in Africa, and I don't know. It just felt kind of different than the individualism I really was struck by when I came back from the Peace Corps. Mm.
Do you feel lonely, Liz, or not?
Sometimes I do, although I'm really kind of glad when I come home to my dog, because I work with a rather kind of difficult group of people, and he seems very sane.
Right.
And I see my neighbors when I walk, but yet I do have to reach out, because I don't find that people reach out to me. And I can see if I were older and in worse health, that would present problems that I don't currently experience.
Right. Mm. I'm glad you have a dog. And you recommend that too, Dr. Kular.
Absolutely. And so for people who are able to care for pets and enjoy caring for pets, certainly having that available can really be a great source of companionship. But I do agree in that we see a level of individualism here in this country that we don't see elsewhere. And that's, when I interviewed Dr. Tang, who started the foundation that I talked about, that was one of the big things that he wanted to drill home and to try to work against, was that here we really have this mentality often that we're on our own, we need to do things by ourselves, and finding ways to break down those barriers like the foundation he started or other kind of community organizations can be very helpful. There's another thing that I wanted to mention, in that there's some researchers at the University of Chicago, Dr. John Cacioppo, and he's one of the leading experts on loneliness and social isolation. He's got this acronym that I think can help a lot of people, and it's called EASE, E-A-S-E. And he advocates the things that people can do to put themselves out there. So the first E in EASE is extend yourself, so making sure that you're putting yourself out there, you're accepting social invitations, even if you don't quite feel like going out for whatever reason, make sure that you accept that invitation. The A is action plan. So have an action plan. So look at your calendar, map out your social life, look at what your week is going to be like, and make sure that you've put some action items on the table that you're going to be getting yourself out there somehow, some way over the course of the week. The S he talks about is sharing times with people who have similar interests. So if you like reading books, join a book club. If you like running, join a runner's group. Whatever it might be, make sure you share times with people with similar interests. And the last is expecting the best. The last E is expecting the best. And so this gets back a little bit to what we were talking about around social cues, is that sometimes people who tend towards loneliness, they kind of analyze ambiguous social cues negatively. But if we can kind of train ourselves to give people the benefit of the doubt and expect the best, that can really go a long way as well.
Mm-hmm. Kathy called in to comment, and I'm glad to hear this. We'll find out and put it on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, what these groups are, how to get in contact with them. But she says there are many sharing groups in Wisconsin, particularly in Milwaukee. So if you look online, it's not just in California. Or you can find them elsewhere, too, which is good to know. So we'll find out more about that. Sarah is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Yes, thank you. I was wondering if I'm ruining my health. I've always been a loner. I spent 11 years in my house, and people would even bring me groceries because I wouldn't go to a store or anything. I'm fine if it's like one-on-one, like an elderly person. If I see someone that looks lonely, I relate to them very well. But if I'm forced to go into a group of people, I find that totally exhausting, and by the time I get home, I go to bed. So I don't know. I've kind of been a loner all my life, but it seems like I'm getting worse as I get older, and I'm just wondering, I think that maybe it's not probably good for my health. I've been trying to get out more. I do go into stores now, but
yeah.
I really don't socialize. I'm, and NPR is pretty much keeps me company all day.
Well, we're socializing now.
Yeah.
Right, Sarah? We're socializing. Dr. Kular, what do you say?
Yeah, so I don't think that you should worry necessarily about ruining your health. One of the distinctions that, you know, people are extroverted, people are introverted, and one of the distinctions that I think is really important to make is the distinction between loneliness and solitude. And so loneliness is kind of a painful, a negative state that you feel kind of acutely, the absence of having social connections and other people in your life. Some people are perfectly happy being alone, and that's more along the lines than of solitude. So solitude can be a positive state. It can help us get in touch with ourselves. It can help us kind of reflect on our lives. You know, I think a healthy balance needs to be struck. So at times it is important to kind of extend yourself and get out there, especially as we grow older. I think there's a tendency to become more and more solitary. But if but many people enjoy being alone and want to be around other people sparingly. And they don't enjoy large crowds. They enjoy one-to-one conversations. And, you know, we always say that having one person in your life that you can talk to is way, way better than having zero. And having two is probably a little bit better than having one. But we certainly don't need, you know, dozens and dozens. So if there are one or two people that you feel like you can rely on and talk to when you want to talk to them, that's certainly okay and should be encouraged.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that, Sarah? People you can, if you feel like it, talk to them?
Occasionally, yeah. Well, like when I had one friend bringing me groceries because I was even too uptight about going into stores, or there were just too many people. And I'm getting better. I've been trying to get out and socialize a little bit. I go to a church every once in a while, mm-hmm. you know, just for the socialization, not necessarily the theology or whatever, just to
be around people.
Yeah,
right.
I try to, but I find myself, you know, making excuses every day. I'm gonna do some such and such today, and then I don't go outside. Like I was gonna go outside today, and buy myself a pair of boots, which I need, and I'm here in the house. I made another excuse, you know, because mm-hmm. it's hard for me, mm-hmm. I guess.
Well, maybe you should come and visit us. Would you like to do that?
I'd love to, Kathleen. You're the one of the joys of my life.
Oh, gee, now you're making me. all right, Colleen will get information from you, and we'll have a cup of coffee, okay?
Oh, you don't have to.
No. I would like to, because I think we'd have fun. You know, you can have some fun.
Yeah.
Come and see what we do. All right, so Colleen will be getting a hold of you. Thank you. You know, I didn't know what to say exactly there because... I don't know, sometimes if she called us, and I would think that there are a lot of people who just, you get in the habit of not doing something. It's like not exercising. Right. It's not taking a walk. Oh, I'll do it tomorrow. But her life might be very much enriched if she were able to get out more.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, the signs around going to church once in a while, I think that can really be encouraged if that can be a weekly thing that she gets out to. And if there's nothing else that she is able to get out for over the course of the week, that would be a very healthy thing. And then I think focusing on cultivating just one or two meaningful relationships, like I said, it doesn't have to be a lot, but having one person or two people that you can rely on makes a huge, huge difference.
Yeah, it does. We don't need tons of friends. We just need people who we can be who we really are with and enjoy life with. Doesn't even have to have a ton of them.
Right.
Okay, Sarah, I hope we'll see you soon. Anita in Gurnee. Hi.
Hi. This is a great show. You know, one of the things that I see around here where I live, and I'm sure they have it in other areas, are, you know, animal shelters. And some of them have a separate residence for cats. And at a certain time of the day, you can go in there, like, I don't know, 2 to 4, let's say, and they'll tell you which cats are socialized, and you can take one and go sit down and pet a cat.
Right.
And one of the shelters near us, there's even a couple of separate rooms, you know, if you want to have, you know, a one-on-one with the cat, and maybe you want to soothe the cat. But, you know, and that's so good for us. And those poor little kitties that have no one, that's a very good thing for them. All you have to do is get there.
I think that's, you know, that sounds like a great program. And I think people often underestimate the extent to which pets, cats, dogs are able to provide purpose. They're able to provide companionship for a lot of people that can be really rewarding. It happens for older people. It can happen in hospitals and clinics as well, but it can also happen for younger people. You know, there's a lot of colleges, there's medical schools, there's other places where people are really stressed, and some colleges are actually buying pets that are kind of communal pets, and that if people want to take a break from studying or take a break from a very hectic day and go socialize with those pets for a couple hours, they're more than welcome to do that. So I think the more that we can recognize that it doesn't just need to be other human contact, other contact with animals and pets can be really meaningful for a lot of people.
Well, and it gets you talking. I talk when nobody's around my house but me. I talk to my dog all the time. We really do. We talk. You know, we talk. Right. He doesn't talk. Well, maybe he does in his own way. But at least you're having interaction with, you know, somebody
right.
else who cares about you, really.
It's right.
To be a good thing. Anita, thank you very much for your call. We have some lines open at this hour of the program. We're talking about how social isolation is killing us. Our guest is a doctor in Massachusetts, and he wrote a very, very important piece, I think, because it's about social isolation killing us, that we are, many of us, very isolated. One-third of Americans older than 65 living alone, half of those 85 and older. Dr. Dhruv Kular is with us. He is a resident physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and at Harvard Medical School. And we're talking about how to, what the correlation is between social isolation and very serious illness and cutting your life shorter, and how to break through that kind of isolation. What's being done to make lives, if you want to be with other people, make that happen. Our number, a couple lines are open right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. And let's take a comment from Allison from East Troy, doctor, who says, I couldn't help thinking of my work as a library director. We often had people coming in, of course, and sometimes I think it was largely because they just needed somebody to say hello to. Hopefully we provided a little bit of valuable social interaction. I'm sure that happens a lot in libraries. People come in for companionship. Are you there, doctor?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh.
Yes, you cut off for a second there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem. Yeah, I know. I think, unfortunately, I think this is one of the things that we're really losing in our kind of modern society. And, you know, places like libraries, other places where people could congregate and get together and just come for a little bit of social interaction, they're kind of going by the wayside now as everything is becoming digital. People go on online to read books. They download them directly
right.
on their iPad. You know, people are buying things on Amazon. They're not going to the mall to socialize, right? And so a lot of the things that we think are making society better or more efficient, in some ways probably are making society better and more efficient, they also have the negative consequence of tearing us apart, because mm-hmm. we're not forced to go to the store and say hello to the cashier and talk to them. We're not forced to go to the library ourselves to go pick out a book and kind of have an offhand conversation with the librarian there. And so I think we need to do a lot more thinking as a society and as a community about how in the digital age we're able to maintain real human emotional connections with other people.
Right. We don't even make phone calls much anymore. We just send a note.
That's right. Everything's text, everything's
right.
email, and picking up the phone is something that not a lot of people do today.
Right. Jeannie in Fox Point, hi.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
What I want to say, you said a third of the people are lonely, but a third of the people of seniors do not have computers. So if you depend on that to them to reach out to programs through their computer, if they don't have it, it's not going to work.
That's right. And so a lot of older folks either don't have computers or aren't comfortable using computers. And so I think that's where we have to be a little bit more creative about other ways that we can reach out to people. And so a lot of places are starting to have things like helplines where people can at least call in just to have a conversation with someone. England has actually done a lot more work in this area than we have here in the UK, and their kind of version of the AARP has set up an array of programs across the country and across cities that are things like sewing circles or current events discussions, book clubs, sports centers, or where places that people can come and congregate don't necessarily require technology. And so, you know, there are increasingly phone lines that we can call into, as I mentioned, but there's also increasingly small group kind of activities that are being set up across places. And like I said, I think the United Kingdom and England is a little bit farther ahead in this respect, but my hope is that articles like this, research that's coming out, discussions like this that we're having kind of spurs people to set up more things like that in the United States as well.
Oscar in Shatek. Hi, Oscar.
Hi. I lost my wife. It's getting to be a few years ago now, but I had a really hard time at her passing, and I went to see a psychiatrist to help cope with it, and she recommended that I do volunteer work, and I was really lonesome for a while after she passed, and I do have family members close by, and I do belong to a church that I go to regularly, and so that all helps, but the volunteer thing for me was really, it's just really gratifying for me to volunteer. I volunteer at an emergency room at a hospital.
Oh, that's big time volunteer work, really, Oscar.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. That really is something I look forward to every week.
Mm-hmm. And it made you feel like you had a purpose. It made you feel, I'm sure, very connected to people who really needed you at that time.
That's right. Yes, and I, in some ways, I think being a volunteer does more for me than it does for the people that I help at the volunteer job.
Mm. Well, don't underestimate the power of you either. That's a good idea to volunteer, Dr. Kular. I'm afraid we're having a little difficulty. Can you hear me? No, I think we've lost the connection with him. Dr. Kular? I don't know what's happened to it. It just sort of evaporated. We'll find him and return and talk about volunteering. We're talking about social isolation. If you didn't read this article, it was in a December edition of the New York Times, and it is an important one, I think. It looks at how social isolation is killing us. Dr. Dhruv Kular wrote the piece, and he works with people who are socially isolated. He is a resident physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and at Harvard Medical School. It's a very moving article about patients who are at the end of their lives. This isn't all the article's about, but people who don't have anybody when they're passing away. And he asks them, if there's somebody I'd like to have you call, and there's nobody. And he looks at what's happening with people's health when they're socially isolated and why we're socially isolated and what we can do to alleviate some of that isolation. We lost the connection. Dr. Kular, I don't know how much you heard of Oscar's great phone call, but his wife passed away some years ago, and
right.
he saw a psychiatrist, and he recommended that he volunteer, and he did in an emergency room, and it's really made all the difference. It's just been important. That's a good recommendation, isn't it?
It is a really fantastic idea, and I think, you know, like he mentioned, one who volunteers gets so much from that experience in terms of purpose and mission and the ability to help other people. But also, you know, think of all the people that he's also touching and helping, and the way that he's probably able to connect with those people in a way that other people who maybe haven't gone through the same trying times can. And so he's really doing a great service for other people in the community, and he's getting a lot out of it as well, it sounds like.
Thanks, Oscar, for calling, too, and your work. Lynn in Onalaska. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have an 85-year-old mother who is living on her own and has for the last 24 years since my father passed away. And she is pretty much on her own during the week. And I live here in Onalaska. She's in St. Paul, Minnesota. So I've been trying to figure out how can I reach out to my mother and just continue a relationship with her. And I've decided to become her pen pal. I'll tell you, it's not easy to find stationery. Not many people write letters anymore. But she loves to write, and she, of course, she writes in cursive. And I thought this would be a great way for us to connect with one another, share our thoughts and ideas, maybe send her a recipe or a craft idea, or just... I just remember as a child getting so excited, going to the mailbox and getting a letter from someone.
I think we all still do, don't we? We love to get letters. We may not write them, but we sure love to get them.
No, that's another really great idea and a great way to stay in touch. And, you know, I'm just so impressed by all the various and creative ways that people are finding to stay in touch with other people. Mm-hmm. You know, there are other programs as well that have kind of been set up between countries. And so a lot of students in other countries who want to try to learn English, they're Skyping with older people in the United States. And that way kind of older people get that kind of social connection with other people through Skype, and the younger folks get to practice their English as well. And so there's all sorts of really creative ways to build those connections. But, you know, the pen pal idea sounds like a great one as well.
Yeah, that's a wonderful idea. Thank you so much for your call. Christine in Bark River. Hi.
Hello there.
Hi, Christine.
Hi. I am enjoying the program, but I do have a question.
Okay.
Sure, go ahead.
Do you believe that the fact that youth are now spending so much time with mobile devices to the exclusion of interacting socially with other youth or family directly, that could be playing a part in not developing social skills? I know there's been some research on the connection between toddlers and later on having problems relating with other students.
Right. I think, you know, I think that's an excellent point. As we've talked about, you know, the kind of digital media is a really double-edged sword. On the one hand, it can connect us with people that we never would have been able to connect with otherwise. On the other hand, it sometimes substitutes for those real human connections, that ability to develop a friendship and see it through and be there for people in real life. And so I think, you know, as much as we can use this type of technology to actually meet people in real life, the better. And so programs that or apps that allow us to meet up with other people with shared interests and common goals, I think that's really important. When those digital technologies start to substitute for those actual connections with other people, those face-to-face connections, that's when I think it's really problematic. And so I think you're making a really, really excellent point, and something that we need to think about as we use these technologies in our everyday life. Can we make them more amenable to meeting up with people in real life rather than just substituting for those real interactions?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Christine, for bringing up that important point. Bill in Grays Lake, Illinois. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. My impression of this is that many people who are severely depressed think a lot about dying, and in many cases want to die, and these physical maladies that eventually causes their death is psychosomatic.
Hmm.
I would wonder if the doctor could elaborate on that.
Yeah, well, certainly in the research and in medicine, we're increasingly seeing that there's a mind-body connection. And so when people are stressed for long periods of time, when they're chronically sleep-deprived, when they're chronically socially isolated, that certainly has an effect on their health in all sorts of ways. And so I think the general point you're making is a good one. You know, my hope is that The earlier that we can catch people in youth or in middle age and help to develop those either social connections or give them greater social support, that can have long-term impacts so that when they're growing older, they still feel supported and connected. A lot of this mind-body connection that's negative gets turned to a positive mind-body connection. So we're thinking positively, we're feeling good about ourselves and our lives, and that keeps us healthy as we age.
We've mentioned people who are middle-aged or older people and the extent of social isolation, but you also write about younger people who have opioid addictions or feeling cut off and are cut off from their circle of friends. Do you work with a lot of young people who are also socially isolated, and how do we address that population?
It's true. And so this certainly, you know, the issues are a little bit different for older people and younger people. Often for older people, they become more and more socially isolated as they age, because a lot of the people that they had previously been in close contact with are starting to pass away. For younger people, it's a different story. And you know, you mentioned substance use and opioid use as a problem. And part of that is we need to try to change the way that we think about these problems from more chronic criminal activity to a chronic disease. But one of the reasons that it's so difficult, I think, to get people to reach out for help is that you know, accepting and declaring that we're lonely really carries a lot of stigma. And so we need to find a way to move past the stigma of not being able to declare that we're lonely and really feel more comfortable reaching out for help. And part of that is the individual themselves reaching out for help, but part of that is us as a medical community, us as a social community reaching out to those people as well and making sure that they're integrated with us.
Cindy is next in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, I just want to say I think the nursing homes and the retirement homes especially have figured this out many years ago, because most of them have a lot of activities that you can be involved with. Unfortunately, some of them are for people who aren't able to get to them. But for the most part, you know, they encourage that. Unfortunately, we're also a society that doesn't value its elderly, which is too bad. And we really need to have more community centers that encourage both the older and the younger to come and get to know each other and do things together.
Right. And I think the point you make is a really good one, in that not everyone, you know, is in a nursing home or has access to one. And so the more that we can create activities around a community that don't necessarily depend on being in a nursing home, whether it's at a YMCA or coffee shops or concerts or book clubs, the more that we can create those types of activities around town and also get the word out about them, I think that'll give people other avenues to meet, to come out together and to start to build some of those connections.
Michelle writes, I had a very lovely friend, mentor, 36 years my senior. She had a great thing that she did. She would connect with younger people. We would go to concerts, art openings, dinners, or just visiting in our homes. I adored her and learned so much from our friendship. I miss her greatly, but man, oh man, what fun we had.
You know, that's really great. And I think our society would benefit a lot if there was a lot more cross-generational talk and connection. And so it's really valuable for younger people to have kind of the advice and the wisdom of the years of experience that older people have. And it's great for older people to be able to interact with some of today's youth and who bring a lot of energy to those conversations and connections. And so, you know, I would certainly be in favor of as much cross-generational talk as we can foster.
Mm-hmm. And what about in the medical community? I'm sure that this article has stirred lots of great conversations that you've had with people in the medical community and beyond, because you point to something that we don't talk about very often.
It is, and I think, you know, a lot of my fellow physicians and nurses and other people in the medical field, what they generally say is, you know, thank you for bringing attention to this issue, because I think a lot of people recognize this in their work, and it's something that they deal with and that they see every day. And so I think the first step is to recognize how many of our patients are suffering with this kind of thing. And once we start to recognize and identify who they are, we can start to connect them with the services that they need around town and around our cities.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kular, for being with us. And for the work you're doing. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Our guest, Dr. Dhruv Kular, his piece is in the New York Times in December, and it will be on our Facebook page, and we'll also put information about groups you can connect with. I'll do this for you and bank time, and then I'll find somebody who will be with me to help me. It's a good thing. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Colleen Duval for on-air production here in our studios. Thanks for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people.